Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 108 of the Writership Podcast. Today, we're talking about narrative drive. I'm Leslie Watts, here with guest editor Anne Hawley, who is the author of the forthcoming historical love story, Restraint. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
And the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
Hey, Anne, welcome.
Thanks, Leslie. Nice to be here. Nice to be back.
Yeah, so Clark is still out in the field, so we're continuing to march on in our own way. And I asked Anne, you may remember Anne from episode 106, joined us for that. And she's here again today. And I just want to mention again your fantastic story, Restraint, that's coming soon. That is, I can't get this out of my mind, that it's Pride and Prejudice meets Brokeback Mountain. And if people want to find out more about Anne, you can reach her at www.annehawleypdx.com, and we'll have that in the show notes. So today we're talking about narrative drive.
A wonderful subject.
Yeah. So we have a quote, and then we can kind of break that down a little before we get into the heart of things today.
We have a wonderful quote from Sean Coyne, who is the author of The Story Grid and a great teacher of mine. He wrote it originally on Stephen Pressfield's blog, and it says, "Narrative drive is that quality that keeps readers riveted. It is the lightning in a bottle that creates great fortunes. If your work has none, forget about it."
Forget about it, yeah.
Forget about it.
Okay, so well, we were talking about our understanding of narrative drive comes from our study with Sean Coyne, and different people have different ideas about what narrative drive is and what pulls people through the story. And that, you know, Valerie and I talked about tension recently, and so there are all these tools. But when we talk about narrative drive in the context of the way Sean talks about it, we're talking about the amount of information that the reader has relative to the character or characters in the scene. And so if you can have a situation where the reader has more information or the same information or less information, and that creates this lovely frisson. It's the only word I can think of. I'm sure there's a better word. I can't even say it any way that doesn't sound odd. But it creates this, you know, lovely, these lovely questions in the mind of the reader, and they're different ways of creating different questions.
And one way of saying that frisson is a desire to turn the page.
Right. It's probably a more
it's more English sounding.
More English sounding. Yes. More straightforward. So we have our submission today. We both really had a big reaction to one of the methods of narrative drive. And it's one that doesn't get used all the time, and that's done with particularly good effect in this scene. So I'm excited to talk about it. We have today Esperanza, which is by Mike Ward. It's a science fiction horror novel. And he was aiming for about 70,000 words when he started out on this journey, and these are the first five pages. Now, we've got some mild adult language and a quite gory injury, so if those things are upsetting or if you're at work, you might want to save this for a different time. So, without further ado, Esperanza by Mike Ward. Esperanza, hope. An older form of the Spanish word, esperando, from the late pre-expansive Earth era. The United Earth Confederate Colonies was deliberate in naming their new flagship, after more than 200 years of expansion and colonization, which had begun with Mars, Titan, and Luna, then continuing outwards to more than two dozen Goldilocks worlds and almost as many orbital nation-states, mankind was once again preparing itself for a new age of exploration, one that would carry them beyond the confines of normal space and through the as-yet theoretical subspace. Underneath the political turmoil that was constantly embattling sovereign local world governments, both against each other in causal territorial disputes and also against the Terran-based confederacy that wanted its thumb in every pie, mankind still had hope. Hope for peace, hope for expansion, hope for evolution, hope for the broadening of sciences and for the universal spirit of life to carry forward to new and unguessable horizons. Underpinning that hope was the Esperanza, whose drive was theoretically capable of piercing space-time to find something beyond. It was therefore a vexation and an embarrassment to Emilio Svensson, chief engineer of said ship, that the damned thing had rust. Some kind of strange corrosion had formed on certain of the computer panels that made the damn thing go. It was some kind of crystallization, not rust exactly, but Emilio couldn't help thinking of it that way. His early career had been as a groundside tech for an aerospace contractor, and he'd had his share of fighting rust and grime and all the detritus that piles up on moving parts when you drag them through raw space. Now that he was employed on contract with the UECC to maintain the new flagship of the Confederacy, here he was dealing with the same old shit. Death, when it came for him, was swift but unmerciful. Emilio was hunched over the open chassis of Esperanza's crash panel, trying to remove some errant crystallization from the nav board with the flat tip of his screwdriver. Emilio paused to pull the cigarette from his dry lip and blow the smoke away from his eye. No smoking was a standard condition in his contract, one which he chose to ignore. If they want the best, he reasoned, don't hire him at his worst. There was a time and a place to quit smoking, and elbows deep in uncooperative space-aged fancy tech was not it. Cigs were illegal on most worlds, but his wife had been from one of the few legal tobacco plantations in the system. He looked at the pale band on the skin around his ring finger, surprised for the thousandth time to find it bare. 13 TS months had passed since she died. It was just as well, he thought. He couldn't have worn a ring to work with electronics. Emilio blinked away a tear. He couldn't help trying to fool himself. He missed his wife. Hot, sharp pain lanced through his shoulder. The suddenness of it sent him reeling. Through the haze of tears, his vision blurred, and he reared blindly backwards. Something was on the back of his neck. He shook it off, heard it fall. Amelia winced. In shock, he dropped the screwdriver from his hand. It clattered noisily on the tread iron floor and rolled. He choked back a scream as the hot pain burned a deep pinpoint of agony into his shoulder muscle. He lowered himself to his knees, using his off hand to probe gently at the wound. What in the hell? When he was a child, he'd been stung once on the foot by a scorpion. That pain had been like this, like being burned by a red-hot needle. He remembered pointing at the sad face for the doctor, indicating the worst pain he'd ever felt. By comparison, though, the scorpion was nothing. This was easily worse, 100 times worse. The heat was spreading, and his arm felt stiff. Using the left hand, he unclasped the collar of his ship suit and peeled back the sleeve of the garment. The cotton undershirt was stretched tight. His shoulder was swelling fast. He rolled the short cotton shirt sleeve up and had a look at the sting. The sight of it made his heart drop into the pit of his bowels. Too panicked to think, he stared mutely at his arm. The skin was beginning to rip at the spot, and a deep red abscess was opening up in his flesh as the swelling worsened. He began to moan, then croak low in his throat as dread overtook him. This was no scorpion sting. This wasn't an accident on the job. He was having a severe reaction to something, and no one else was around for, God knows, 1,000 kilometers? He missed his wife. She was always cool in a storm. He began to dig his fingernail into the abscess, desperate to find a stinger or a foreign object, hoping that removing it would somehow help. The strange crystallization that had come over the components inside the nav board seemed to appear on Emilio around his wounds. That wasn't possible, he was sure. No way he had been so careless as to have done that. No, it wasn't on him. It was in him. It was inside him. His own meat was crystallizing inside him, and his skin was crusting over. He scrabbled at the ground, trying to stand and run and collapse in terror all at the same time, managing only a spindly climb across the tread iron floor. There was his screwdriver. He'd dropped it. His vision swam in front of him, barely aware of himself. He picked it up. The crystals spread across his bruising skin. In the naked silence of Esperanza's crash box, he heard the horrible, tearing sound from the tight split of his skin as it tore down the length of his swollen right arm. He drove the screwdriver into the wound, far deeper than he'd meant. He thought he could dig out the infection somehow. He was spilling like wine. He crept along the floor towards nothing. His whole body felt like it was on fire. The pinkish yellow gore that poured from him as his arm, Deliquest, was hardening into a mat on the floor. Alexia, his wife, the corners began to dab, climbing. To climb the walls, he couldn't think straight, and it was this sticky, yellowish, purple, luminescent, yeah, I was like yellow, crystals with purple luminescence coming off of those real, ugly, like a bruise. Emilio shook his head. He was losing his mind. "Emil, don't ever let me lose my mind," she said. "If I'm ever that bad off, you'll help me, right?" He hadn't. Oh, Alexia. There wasn't much more in the way of conscious thought after that. He became a worm, a ganglionic, writhing mass. His mind was gone. He was only meat now. Barely that anymore. Hours later, he would finally stop decomposing. There was only the smallest hint of movement in the room, and then settling to none. The spider which had laid its egg sac under the swamp of crystallizing viscera was long gone by the time Emilio's corpse would be discovered.
Wow.
Yeah. So, he's having a bad day.
Yeah, worst day of his life, I'd say.
Yeah. So, when we talked about this earlier, we were, it's a little overwhelming, the scene, because we, you know, when we're, if you don't recognize for some reason by the cover of the book that you're dealing with a science fiction horror story, then you're going to be a little shocked when you read the scene.
Absolutely. And there's a piece of narrative drive for you right there. The cover tells you something that the people in the book don't know yet. And that's, you are already, you, hopefully the cover does give you something to go on. And you go into the story already knowing what type of story it is, whereas this poor Emilio character doesn't know he's in a horror story in the first few paragraphs.
Right, that's really a shame for him.
Yeah.
Poor guy. So I want to talk about that a little bit, especially because we have a specialized genre here. You know, we have it's a horror story, and the setting the setting and the circumstances and all of that is science fiction. And we talked about how it's hard science fiction because we're into the machinery and
the subspace drive and the planets. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we get that right away, right? When we get about
the opening line, sure.
Those opening paragraphs where we find out about where we're, you know, the United Earth Confederate colonies and the other worlds and the political situation between among the various governments and. And so we kind of get a snapshot of the world, and then we get into Emilio's experience, where he's working on this ship that is a great, like, it's the hope for peace and the hope for all of the, you know, evolution, expansion, all of those values that were mentioned in the paragraph near the beginning. And so we go from all the hopes of a generation down to Emilio, who's working on this darn ship that has corrosion.
Right. And I loved that descent of the camera, if you will, you know, that's huge view high up, and then boom, down into this guy and the rust and the screwdriver and the attitude. It was great.
Yeah, and we find out a lot about Emilio in a short time. We, you know, one of the things you mentioned was how efficiently the author characterized Emilio and gained our sympathy for him, and, you know, helped us relate to him. In this beginning, which makes it a little harsh, a little George R. R. Martin-ish, when we get the line, "Death, when it came for him, was swift but unmerciful." And right, that's the line that tells you that we're not in just a straight up science fiction, like adventure story or thriller story. You know, we're in something that is, it's not good. It's not going to be a happy, fun adventure.
It begins to clue us into the horror aspect.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And
it also provides us with a very important piece of information that the character doesn't have.
Right. So this is one this is one of the components of narrative drive, you know, in that we're, though in the way that we're talking about it and how much information the reader has versus the character or characters in the scene. And so that's a big piece of information. So when Emilio is attacked, or, you know, he sustains the injury, and at first we don't really know exactly what it is, the question isn't, is he going to live or die? It's in part, you know, it's how is he going to die? And then, you know, as we get further into the scene, there's a question of how is he going to meet his death, essentially. And
right.
So that it's really significant that the reader or that the author chose to reveal that at this point, because it gets us thinking in a different way about the scene and asking, you know, raising different questions in our minds.
Right. It tells us, for one thing, that Emilio isn't going to be with us long. So whatever our attachment to him is at this point, our question is going to be, what's going to happen to him?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a swift and unmerciful death. So the first question I have is, holy cow, what's the connection between this corrosion, which is a pretty creepy word all by itself, and his, you know, he's setting up a great many little questions, and then of course the big one of how is he going to die?
Yeah.
As you say, how is he going to meet his death, which is a question that we come to as he begins to, after he sustains the injury and begins to react to it, but also what caused it?
Right.
What happened? Oh my God, what happened?
And there's this lovely twist, right? Because, you know, we would normally think a quick death might be more merciful. Like, you know, people will oftentimes, when someone dies, they'll find at least some comfort in the fact that they died quickly or they didn't know what happened. And
right.
And that we're told right up front, yeah, it's quick, but yeah, he suffers.
But not quick enough. Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Yeah, and how he suffers. I mean, because it's not just the pain, right? Because it's the worst, you know, we find out it's the worst pain he's ever experienced. So it's not just that, you know, a spider has bitten him and he's, you know, and it's pain, you know, a sting is painful. It's like 100 times worse than the worst pain he'd ever sustained.
Right.
And then he's watching his, so it's painful. Then he sees it and he's, you know, that it's really bad. The swelling is bad. He's having some kind of reaction. So we're just kind of building up to this, like he notices that that it has the same quality of the corrosion that was in the nav board, and that, you know, it's like, wait, I didn't do that. That wasn't an accident. It wasn't something that I could have done. But even as he's, you know, he's fighting, he fights it, you know, first by trying to claw it out and then with the screwdriver. But then, you know, in his last moments, like his last coherent thoughts are of how he failed his wife.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's gut-wrenching, right?
It is. It's brilliantly done. The author has made us care about this guy so much, even though we know he's not going to live past the end of the scene. We know that from that one line.
Yeah.
And yet, I feel so strongly for his horror and his terror and his pain and his loss, and yeah, I miss him. I mean, it's a very powerfully written scene.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, you know, I mentioned the George R. R. Martin prologue, or I didn't, I guess, I'm not sure I mentioned specifically
did,
the
I
prologue,
think.
But yeah, so in that story, you have a lordling, and I can't think of his name right off the top of my head. Somebody out there will remember. But we don't really get attached to him because he's a jerk. And so when he is, you know, he meets his death by White Walker, we don't, you know, it tells us, you know, it conveys very strongly that you can get to know people and then they are going to be, die. So it's, you know, it sets the expectation in part for the series, or you know, overall. And so I think too in this scene, but the difference is that and I'm trying to think of who Emilio reminds me of, but he reminds me of some character on the edge of my mind who is, you know, he's a likable guy, you know, he's not,
yeah.
he's someone you wouldn't, you know, that you like and that you get to, you know, like we've gotten to know him. And even if he's not someone we would necessarily hang out with all the time, he's a character that we have, as you say, attached to in a very short time. And we feel for him. He's lost his wife. And then, yeah, and then to die so brutally and mercilessly, that it's really powerful. And I was saying earlier, right, that horror isn't a genre that I'm naturally drawn to, but I think that the author has done a really powerful job of opening this and letting the reader know what to expect, even though, you know, we say we haven't read the rest of the novel, but if this goes the way that we think it's going to go, and based on the synopsis that the author shared with us, that this is a great setup.
It's a fantastic setup. And I was going to say, I don't know whether the author intended this, and maybe that's not very important, but it's interesting to me that Emilio, one of the reasons we can relate to him is that he is down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ironic because he's up in space. And that's a nice, you know, he's a regular guy. He's a blue collar, you know, guy with a screwdriver and a wrench and rust, and he's an engineer character, like Scotty or somebody,
mm-hmm.
With an attitude, and, you know, he's, but that quality of down-to-earthness in space is a very nice touch.
Yeah, yeah, I hadn't caught that, so I'm glad you mentioned that. That's really, he does, he has that very salt-of-the-earth feel to him.
Even to the point of he has a memory of being stung by a scorpion, which at least hints that he grew up on Earth.
Yeah.
That as a child he lived in the desert somewhere and got stung by a Scorpio.
Yeah.
And that's a nice, you get a nice feeling about, a nice clear sense of him with very few words. It's very well done.
Yeah. So pulling it back to narrative drive a little bit, and how we, in, you know, in this scene, there are some things that, you know, like we know he's going to die. And at the very end, after he's died, we find out what killed him, that it's this really nasty spider. We don't even have to see it to know that it's a really, just because we know of its, what it does, and, you know, how it, lays its eggs, essentially, is not very...
It's horrific.
Yeah.
It's horrifying. And yet I think an interesting question to ask, because like you, I am not a natural reader of horror. I read some. I don't go to horror movies,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking, but I'll watch some horror TV shows. So, you know, I have a mixed sense of myself as an audience for horror. But it's an important question for me to ask myself, why was I willing to read every word of that hideous description of his of his wound, of his, of what's happening to his body. I mean, it's truly horrifying. And yet I was willing to read it. It was gross, but I didn't feel bludgeoned over the head by sheer violence for its own sake. I felt the balance between this character who I already felt some sympathy for. I was horrified viscerally, but more than that, I was so upset for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so bringing in that human element, showing me this person, knowing that he's going to die, part of the narrative drive for me is that sense of being introduced to this person I care about. And so I'm willing to keep turning the page or keep reading the next paragraph of a very lengthy description of what's happening to his body. Normally, I would skip over those things. I would kind of shut my eyes or kind of cover my eyes in the movie or something, because often it is just bludgeoning you over the head with violence. And this is meaningful violence. It's a meaningless death for Emilio, but it's meaningful violence in the context of, holy cow, this something terrible is building in this world that he's just given us. And so I'm not putting that in maybe the most technical terms, but that's one of the narrative, one of the things that drives it narratively for me, is that I care.
Yeah. And I think also that, you know, I had the same response that I don't normally like a lot of gore, but here I was looking for clues. What the heck is the thing that attacked him?
True, that
invaded, or, you know, what is that? And so I'm, even though it's something I would normally skip over, it's I'm looking for those clues. And that's the power of knowing that he's gonna die. Because if the question in this scene was, is he gonna live or is he gonna die, then I'm more likely to skip over that gory part, because all I want to know is, does he live or die?
Right, I want to see him stand up again or wind up in the hospital bed with the monitors beeping or something. And that's not going to happen here, and you already know that.
And
the other thing, that the other piece of narrative drive, is that neither he knows nor you and I know what did this to him.
Yeah.
So there's that huge question of what, we know he's going to die, so we need to know, desperately need to know, how come?
Yeah.
What caused, maybe not why, but what the cause was.
What the cause is, and so that's another big piece of that. You know, we know more because I suspect, I don't know, again, what happens in the next scene when what's left of him is discovered, that I'm assuming that the people who discover him won't know what happened either, because the spider's long gone, and that he will have, you know, I think the description was that, that the viscera, right? Like who knows, it might have all transformed enough that you wouldn't even tell that it was a person at all. And so we're the only
walking over the hardened mat of his viscera and not even know they're doing it.
Yeah. And so we know what the other characters don't know, which is that this beast is on the loose and it's just laid a bunch of eggs. So guess what? There's more coming. And that, yeah, that is truly, truly horrifying. So,
and we know from other science fiction horror, of which, you know, this is clearly a descendant of, like, Alien, that we know what the monster's motivation is. It's reproduction, obviously. I mean, that we've got, so we know how inexorable that is.
Yeah.
All he has to do is egg sac and spider, and we know what motivates the monster, at least part of what motivates the monster.
Right.
And we know that this corrosion, which has something to do with it, looks and seems to act just like ordinary, whatever space rust is, or, you know, ordinary corrosion. Because we've seen Emilio, a talented and experienced engineer, scraping away at it nonchalantly, you know. And so you have a feeling someone else is going to do the same thing, and it's going to take more than once before they figure out, they being whoever else is alive in the story, figures out what's going on.
Yes, yes. And I was thinking about, you know, as you were talking about, because you reached the conclusion that I did as well, that he's a talented person. And we get that in part, I think, at least for me, I think the line when he's, you know, thinking if they want the best, he reasoned, yep, don't hire him at his worst. So in his mind, certainly. And since this is a very important ship, you know, it's the flagship, it's the hope. So like that's at least in part accurate. And so, you know, that's part of that characterization that we get really quickly and efficiently.
Yeah, he's the best at his job.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're willing to put up with the fact that he smokes.
Right. He can break some rules because he's just that good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So his loss is therefore all the more important. And as we sort of dig into this, one of the subliminal questions, it's not in the text, but it comes to mind as I'm thinking about it, is whoever's left, you know, to see that this flagship gets off the ground or out into subspace or whatever,
yeah,
they're missing like a really, really important engineer already.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, just subliminally, that sets up another little question for down the road, you know?
Yeah.
It's an excellent scene.
Yeah, so we've got
It does its work.
And the use of giving the reader more information than the characters have is really effective. And when we were talking about this, we were thinking about, you know, that there's having the same amount of information as the characters, and there's having less information than the characters. And giving the reader less information than the character or characters have is one of the most common ways of pulling people through.
Right, you get the reader to be asking questions,
yeah,
about why they're behaving the way they are, and then you drop in the little hints as the story unfolds. Very common, mm-hmm, very common narrative drive. Works well.
Yeah, and then there's when we as the reader have the same amount of information, and that's pretty common too, I think, in a lot of, you know, where we have a sleuth, essentially, who's, you know, finding things out, and, you know, we find out the clues as they do, that's another right, common way. And that this method here is less common, but used more in things like thrillers and horror stories, where, you know, you really need to pull out all the stops, I think, to, you know, you have to shake things up to keep
right,
the reader from just kind of settling into some calm. You know, if it's meant to be a fate worse than death, like that's one of the values that we're playing with in these stories. And so you have to keep the reader off balance. And one of the ways to do that is to vary those different narrative drive techniques.
Narrative drive. One thing that's interesting about this, and we are really talking about that one line, death when it came for him was swift but unmerciful. One thing that distinguishes this use from the typical horror, what I think of as a typical horror device is, let's say a horror movie where you get some scenes in the evil monster's point of view, right? The serial killer or whatever it is.
Right.
So you learn as the audience that this guy is over here, he's upstairs, he's in the closet. You already know that because you've seen it from his point of view, right?
Yeah.
So when you see the blonde teenage girl going up the stairs, you're going, don't go up the stairs, don't go up the stairs, he's out there. You already know that because the narration has given you that from the bad guy character's point of view, the monster's point of view. In this case, it's a strictly omniscient overview. It's an outsider perspective that just tells you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't show us the spider sneaking around behind a... Like, cinematically, you would see a spider's leg, a big, giant spider's leg, I don't know, disappearing behind a bulkhead or something, right?
Yeah.
But you don't get that here. He just tells you. It's a very distinctive choice.
Right, and you couldn't, like... you couldn't do that in a movie, right? Because you can't.
No, you really couldn't, except if you had a voiceover.
Unless you have a voiceover, and that would be really cheesy.
And this is the beauty of writing a novel. You get to do some things like this.
Yeah. Ah, well, this is fun. Well, okay, so in the past, I sometimes get a little flack if I don't ever say something that the author could do to improve. And for me, there were, you know, this is an early draft, so I'm not gonna, you know, there are a few typos and that kind of thing. And so that's something you would do, you would look at later.
Right.
But you mentioned, and I don't disagree about the, that we're getting a lot of backstory about the world, and perhaps a little too much, particularly in that second paragraph of it, it's actually the third paragraph of the scene, but it's the second paragraph of, you know, what we would call like world building backstory, whatever.
Right. Yeah. I felt like, he gives us, right after he introduces the ship, Esperanza Hope, right after the first sentence, basically, he gives us a setting, the United Earth Colonies, there's a flagship, 200 years, Mars, Titan, and he gives us the setup of a sort of a space empire sort of thing. It's quite clear. It solidly places what type of science fiction we're dealing with. And then he gives us a second paragraph that I think is very interesting. Underneath the political turmoil, battling sovereign local world governments, etc., finger in every pie, the Terran world, you know, wants to control things. Pretty standard science fiction space empire setup, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doubles over some of the information that we just got in the previous paragraph. And I felt like, you know, he could sprinkle this political background. It's only 68 words. It's not like a huge chunk of change, but it's one very long, breathtaking sentence, as you noticed when you read it in three different breaths.
Yeah.
The detail could come later after it slowed down. If we're talking about narrative drive,
mm-hmm.
I've got enough to know that we've got an as yet theoretical subspace. There's a danger signal there. It's interesting. And I just want to go straight into the action. So that would be, that is like the only quibble I have with this entire scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a small one. It's not like it absolutely has to be taken out. If I were structurally editing this, I would say, consider moving some of this information a little bit later in the story, because we don't need it right here.
Yeah. And I think it could be tightened up. You know, as again, this is an early draft, so it could be tightened to avoid some of the, you know, there's some repetition and that. I like that we get. Okay, yeah, so that's interesting. Because at first I was thinking, well, you know, I kind of like this hope for peace, hope for expansion, hope for evolution, and that.
But, I do too.
But we get, you know, Esperanza, like he makes a point, that first sentence, this is going to be about hope, actually, the antithesis of hope.
Right.
We find out by the end of the scene, but that, is it too, maybe it's too much, maybe you could save that, as you say, for later. So it's something to think about, for sure.
Yeah, that paragraph, and again, if this is an early draft, I mean, I'm deeply impressed because it's awfully good. But that one paragraph about the politics does strike me as a movie voiceover.
Uh-huh, yeah.
A little bit. Like, you know, I'm just giving you, like, is it Galadriel who gives the long voiceover at the beginning of Lord of the Rings? You know, because you got to set it up and it's complicated. You don't need to do that in a novel.
Yeah, or I'm also thinking of the way that in the Star Wars films you get that
moving
text kind of scrolling.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that.
It's very much like that. And I'm not saying you absolutely can't do it. It's just because you felt like we should call to light something that doesn't quite work, that's the only thing I can find.
Yeah, I think that a lot of it that it's just stuff you would, you know, anything else I found would be stuff that you would clean up later and mm-hmm. and not look at it when you're looking for the story stuff. And so I think this is really nicely done and a great example of this, you know, revealing information to the reader that the character has no idea about, to just kind of yeah.
So that you're sitting in your seat going, no, don't go up the stairs. Yeah. Except in this case, you know he's gonna. I mean, there's no question.
It's so
he's gonna die, and yet you keep reading because you care about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and how is it? And yeah. So I could go on and on, but
sitting here, can I just say, Mike Ward is listening. Mike, this is a fantastic scene.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah, I hope he's going to listen.
I hope so too.
I'll write to him and tell him it's okay. He can, you know, some authors are they submit and then they feel really nervous about, you know, about hearing the feedback and that. So
I can totally understand that fear.
I know. It's it can. And so which is a great time to point out that how much I appreciate everyone who sends their submissions in, because, you know, we can't do the show without submissions. And in a lot of cases, this is the first time the authors have sought feedback on their stories. I don't know that that's Mike Ward's case, but, you know, there are a lot of authors who sent, you know, they're like, I don't know, you know, how this is, and they send it, and which is such a brave thing to do.
That's fantastically courageous.
Yeah, and so
anyone who does that's amazing.
I know, it's really, because you don't know what you're gonna get, and then it's gonna be, you know, other people are gonna hear it, and so it's incredibly brave, and I'm so incredibly grateful for everyone who sends their submissions in, because it's really, it's fun. I love doing this, so
great. I love doing it too. It's fun.
I'm so glad you came.
I am too.
So, okay, so we probably need to wrap things up, but before we go, we of course have an editorial mission.
Editorial mission, yay!
So, this week, surprise, surprise, I want you to check for Narrative Drive. And this is a good idea, of course, and especially good idea if you have a scene that, you know, or a section of your story that's moving really slowly, or if you get feedback from, say, a beta reader or, you know, or other readers that, you know, this part's a little slow, then you definitely want to look at Narrative Drive. But also, just generally speaking, kind of look at what your go-to is. Do you tend to provide the same information that the characters have, or more or less? And you know, kind of so that you're changing it up, so it's not the same every time. And so, in particular, you might, as I said, take a slow scene, look at what you're doing, and then look at how you might change it. Like, consider, would there be a stronger way to do this, to change the question that the reader is focusing on as they go, you know, as they're reading, that might be a stronger pull for the reader to continue reading. And some of that's going to depend on the genre, and some of that's going to depend on your very specific audience in the form of your ideal reader. But really think about what's going to give you the most bang for your buck. So, and a reminder that you can go to writership.com/episodes to sign up to get these editorial missions delivered right to your box. And if you usually listen to the podcast while you're on the go, this is a great solution. So you can make use of these practical exercises. So, yeah, that's it for the editorial mission.
Great. Well, remember that the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
And the fantastic Jim Kukrol and Author Marketing Club cover the hosting and technical support for the podcast, but our Patreon crew supports our time in preparing for the show, and you can support us there too and earn some extra rewards. To find out more about that, you can visit patreon.com/writership. If you enjoyed the show, another way you can support us is by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And finally, if you're feeling brave and you want to push yourself a little bit and you want to send in your 5 pages to be reviewed, please visit writership.com/submissions. Finally, be sure to check out episodes of The Book Editor Show, which Clark hosts with Peter Turley. That's it for episode 108. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.